It's that time, folks. It's 7 o'clock. Let's rock. We have spared no expense because we have very little money. Direct from the far-off land of Sun City, California, please help me welcome up Bob.
Hi, my name is Bob Lahan, a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And it's nice to be here. I've been here before, but you've grown a little bit since the last time. Both the building has grown as well as the attendance here has grown. But it's nice to be back, nice to be asked to come back again. And sometimes I go places and they never ask me to come back anymore, so I appreciate here. I always say I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. When I first came into Al-Anon, I heard people say, oh, grateful member of Al-Anon. I thought it was some sort of a ritual or a rote that they did. And then several years after I was in Al-Anon and following some meditation one morning, I came to realize that I was grateful for Al-Anon because I had found something in, that I had been looking for all of my life. And that was how to get rid of the knot in my stomach, how to be comfortable in life and everything. And I realized that Al-Anon gave me that ability to be comfortable, a thing called contentment. And then I did a little bit more thinking, and sometimes that's kind of dangerous in Al-Anon, but in AA they say go to a lot of meetings, don't drink between meetings, and Al-Anon go to a lot of meetings, don't think between meetings, you know. But I got to thinking, well, how did I get to Al-Anon? Because of an alcoholic wife. And I had to be grateful. And I am grateful that I'm married to an alcoholic wife. Because if it was not for her, I wouldn't be here. No, I'd probably still be out in the street trying to find that thing called contentment, you know. So I'm a very, very grateful member of Al-Anon. I have an alcoholic wife, have an alcoholic son, a son-in-law, three grandchildren, and I guess that qualifies me for Al-Anon, doesn't it? Yeah. Quite a number of years ago, my wife and I had the privilege of going up to Vancouver, Washington to speak at a conference up there, a convention. And we thought, well, we'd make a vacation out of it. Let's take a week off. We went up there, rented a car, drove around the islands and everything, had a wonderful, wonderful time. Then it was time to go into the hotel to register, that 5-star hotel that they have up there. And my wife was sitting in the car outside. And as I registered, they said, whatever you might want, just sign your name for it. Conventional, pick it up and everything, you know. And I was walking back to that car. I thought, what have I ever done to deserve this? And then I realized before Al-Anon, I used to say the same thing. What did I ever do to deserve this? But I often hear people say that we're special people. I don't think we're special people. I think we're deserving people. And that by we have given the tools then to have a good, meaningful life. And because of that, we are deserving goodness to happen to us. And my wife was sitting out in the car, went back to there, and I said, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be experiencing things like this. She said, well, I knew someday you would appreciate me. But we've had a great life on the program. Very, very wonderful life. I was going to tell somebody what happened to me about my higher power, how it works. I had the privilege of going to Maui in May to a convention out there in Maui. And I made airline reservations through Travelocity. My higher power knows that I like to have an aisle seat. But the only seat left on that particular flight, which was going to go to Oahu and then another connecting flight into Maui, was in clear in the back in the center section. Well, okay. So I had this flying out of Los Angeles, LAX, and if there's any place I'd rather not be, it's LAX. And I got there for an 8:45 flight about 7 o'clock. I was at the gate about 7 o'clock. And up on the board, it said, flight delayed till 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock, another one, flight delayed till noon. And then another one, flight delayed till 2. And then flight delayed till 4. And at 4 o'clock, they gave us chips to go to other airlines. And I got a chip to go to Delta Airline. And I went up to get a boarding pass at Delta Airline. And first thing he said, you want an aisle seat or you want a window seat? And I said, God, you didn't have to go to all that trouble to get me an aisle seat. I had to wait 11 hours in LAX to get an aisle seat. But it's kind of an interesting thing on that Delta flight. It was direct to Maui. I didn't have to go through Oahu. But that's how my higher power works for me. I don't know about you, whether you have a good higher power or not, you know. I was up in Santa Monica one time, got a number of years ago, and I got there a little bit early, and I was talking to the secretary who was there. And she said she had been in Al-Anon about 3 years and about ready to leave Al-Anon because she had reached all of her goals. She had started that meeting. She had been the secretary. She had been a GR. Had found a husband in Al-Anon. Had reached all of her goals. And she asked me, she said, Bob, what are your goals? And I said, I don't have any goals. If I had a goal and I ever reached it in Al-Anon, I wouldn't have to come back anymore, would I? So I don't have any goals. I just keep showing up, showing up, showing up. And that's my commitment to Al-Anon, just to show up. I was sharing a little bit with Scott about how we just keep saying yes when we're asked to do certain things in Al-Anon, and that sort of expands us. Saying no always contracts. Yes always expands. So I learned in Al-Anon, always say yes. Find reasons to say yes rather than excuses to say no. Now, I happen to be a step study person. You know, this program of Al-Anon deals with solutions, and it doesn't deal with problems. Lots of meetings, they concentrate on the problem. Now, when you start concentrating on the problem, did you know that you expand the problem? You intensify the problem? Now, the true Al-Anon, then, is on recovery, talking about the solution. So in Al-Anon, we talk about the solution. So our format for speaking is what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. I like to talk about what happened. What happened, because that's the solution. And one of the things that I found, for me, was a step study. I was living in Riverside at the time. There was one Al-Anon meeting there at the time, and I heard a lot of complaining at the meeting. And I was talking to a couple of other ladies, and I said, you know, if the steps are the solution, let's try to find out a little bit more about what these steps are. So we started a step study meeting, and that was one of the first step study meetings of Al-Anon in Southern California, trying to look at and dissect, finding all of these avenues of what these steps really mean, not just the surface, but go inside those steps, what they really mean. And that was some 40-some years ago. We started that step studies meeting. I still go to step study meetings in my life in over 40-some years to try to find the real essence of what this is all about. Now, I don't know whether you have looked at the steps or not, but that's our program of recovery. And if you look at it closely, there's only one promise in those 12 steps. It has nothing to do with the alcoholic. It has nothing to do with finances. It has nothing to do with the house that might be foreclosing. It has nothing to do with the job. It has nothing to do with the kids that might go astray. The only promise in those 12 steps is in the 12th step, where it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's the only promise. Now, it doesn't explain what that spiritual awakening is. And I had trouble with that. And I was probably in the Al-Anon program about 7 years when I had my first spiritual awakening. Now, there's a difference for me between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. A spiritual experience is something that happens out there. A spiritual awakening is something that happens internally to change myself permanently in my perception. And after about 7 years, I had that following meditation. It came to me so simply. But it's something that I have never lost since I had that experience. And what it was everything's okay. Now, you know, people say, oh, yeah, no, oh. I don't mean it that way. I don't mean it that way. What I mean is that internally, I have never, since that instant, lost that feeling that it's all okay. Now, that doesn't mean that everything's hunky-dory, everything's beautiful. It doesn't mean that there isn't some painful things in life. It doesn't mean that at all. I had a woman one time, a long time ago, she was sitting next to me at her second Al-Anon meeting, and she had a violent alcoholic husband at home. I said, it's okay. It's okay. She believed me. She didn't know how to drive a car. She came to that meeting on a bicycle. And she said that night, as she went home, every time the pedal went down, she said, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. And she walked in the house, and her husband was passed out on the sofa. And she said, it's not okay. And it took a couple of years for her to realize that it was okay, because her perception of okay was that he would be sober in a three-piece suit with a bouquet of flowers to take her out to dinner. That was her perception was okay. But the okayness was there was no violence that night. You see? So this is what we get all screwed up on, is our perception of what is okay. So we can go through a lot of trauma, and if we look for it, there's always some good in there, if we'll just hold on to it. I had my second spiritual awakening when I was in the program about 10 years. It came the same way, following meditation one morning. We came to realize that every experience is a spiritual experience, that we're in school here, and sometimes we just don't like the homework. That life gives us lessons. And these lessons, all through all of these experiences, have some meaning there. And most of the time, we judge an experience as either good or bad, rather than looking within the experience to say, what is life trying to teach me through that experience? One of the things I had to ask myself, what was there about me that made it necessary to have an alcoholic in my life? Because it was not by accident. I see this happen, all of you have seen this happen, where the alcoholic in somebody's life, they get a divorce, they turn around and remarry, and there's another alcoholic, get rid of that one, and sure enough, another one. Not stopping to say, what is there that's drawing this person to me? What is there about me that's drawing that person to me? What's the lesson there, you know? And this is what I've discovered in Al-Anon. In Al-Anon, we always talk about problems. Problems. Did you know that a problem is never now? Did you know right this second, nobody at this very instant has a problem unless you need to go to the bathroom real quick? But if your mind gets out of control and you think about last night or yesterday or the what if of tomorrow, you can pick up a problem. But right this second, there's no problem, you know? One of my favorite experiences was down in Louisiana. I was speaking down there at a conference in Louisiana, and a woman wanted to talk to me about some of her problems. I said, well, let's meet for breakfast tomorrow morning. We can talk about your problem. So we met the next day at breakfast. She ordered her breakfast, and part of her breakfast was toast. And she was holding this piece of toast in her hand, her elbow on the table, telling me about all those problems she had. And these were normal living experiences that she had, that everybody has. And I was listening very intently. Now, I don't know if you sponsor people, if you listen very intently, they get excited because you're listening, right? So she was listening, she's just going on and on, and finally said, you know, in 6 months, this might happen. 9 months, this might happen. She just blurted out. I said, Bob, what should I do? And with no hesitation, I said, why don't you eat your toast? So that was the only thing she had to deal with that particular time. Later, I found out that all of those so-called problems that she had all been taken care of. I know that when you're sponsoring people, if you're sponsoring people, they call, they have all these horrendous problems, you know, and you talk it out, you talk about the steps and the solution, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and then they go about their way. And next week they call with another horrendous problem. And you say, well, what happened to the problem you had last week? What was that? I said, oh, don't you remember? Oh, that took care of itself. You see? So we always find that problems are always ahead of us and never now. Never now. And so I learned that in this program. Now, we had a normal alcoholic home that there was no difference. This all started back in 1944. I was going through Navy flight training to become a Navy pilot. And I had met my wife, my future wife, about a year before at some pre-flight training in Nebraska, and we'd corresponded and had a little time down in Corpus Christi, Texas, and she came down to visit me. And a Navy cadet was not supposed to be married. You could not get into the program if you were married, and if you were, they found out you were married, automatic washout. But we were having a party with a bottle of gin up in the hotel with another couple who, on the sly, had gotten married. And they thought it was a pretty good idea to get married. And so we agreed that maybe we ought to get married. And this other woman worked for a judge there in Corpus Christi, Texas, and she called the judge that night, Saturday night, said that we wanted to get married, and the judge said he would go down and get a license the next day at the courthouse and find a minister, we'd get married. And this is what happened. We got married on that Sunday morning. I had to be back to base that night. My wife found an apartment. I always tell that story to tell you the power of sex and alcohol. You put those two things together and anything can happen. And my wife used to always say that when she drank, everything seemed like a good idea. You know. But we started out this marriage, incidentally, we celebrated 65 years last April of marriage. So, no congratulations, sympathy. But anyway, we started this marriage out. I had about every sixth, seventh day off, and every sixth or seventh day we'd do the same thing. We would get a bottle. We'd go out to a honky-tonk, and down in Texas, you couldn't have the the liquor up on top of the table, but they always had a little place underneath the table where you could sip that bottle. And we would have this party, and this went on progressively. And alcoholism in my wife was a very, very gradual affair. That is this mic? It's dead, isn't it? Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. It sounds dead up here.
It got dead.
But anyway, alcoholism in my wife was very, there it is again. Okay. Was very, very gradual and steady over a period of years. And all of our life was... social life was spent with somebody drinking in parties. And now I got my commission, I was a Navy officer, and Navy officers are supposed to be married to ladies. And sometimes my wife wouldn't be ladylike. So I had to caution her verbally. And she wouldn't mind me. And sometimes then I would have to use my Al-Anon elbow to get her attention or social situation. And sometimes I even went to the point where I'd pinch her when nobody was looking. And a couple of times I'd hit her. And that was all for her benefit, not mine. So trying to control her. At that point, I should have been an Al-Anon and she should have been an Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Because I was trying to control something that was uncontrollable, you know. But this was over a period of years that this happened. I got out of World War II and went back to college. didn't have much money, but on every weekend we'd chip in a couple of dollars and with other people and buy the booze and have a party, you know. Then I was recalled during the Korean War. Ended up in California, down in Long Beach. And And it was at that point then that the alcoholism really started coming up. We lived next to a couple, and David knows them, Frank and Jenny H. Both passed away. And we used to have a lot of parties with them. And I'd take a bottle over to their house, and I'd say, let's save half of this for next week. And I couldn't understand why how Frank and Goldine had to finish that bottle. But one nice thing about the Al-Anon program, regardless of that pamphlet called Understanding Alcoholism, how can I ever understand alcoholism if I am not an alcoholic? My wife understands thoroughly why an alcoholic will drink. I do not understand why an alcoholic will drink once they find out that they're an alcoholic. The difference is my wife, the alcoholic, has an allergy of the body which I do not have. And that's why I could stop in the middle of a drink and she could not. And the only difference that kept me from being an alcoholic was that I did not have that allergy. I was a heavy drinker, but I was not an alcoholic because I didn't have that allergy, and I could stop drinking in the middle of a drink, you know. But another interesting thing, Al-Anon has a little term called acceptance. Now, understanding is an intellectual act. Now, I can read all that literature back there on the table. I can go to all kinds of discussions about alcoholism. I can listen to all the speakers and get understanding, but that will not change a situation. What it takes, then, is a spiritual act called acceptance. And so Al-Anon deals with spirituality called acceptance rather than understanding. And this is what I had to learn in Al-Anon. But while we were in Long Beach, anger started coming out. I was angry at my wife. I was angry at the kids that we had. I was angry at traffic. I was angry at the people I was dealing business with. I was constantly angry. I used to think that my wife's alcoholism caused me my anger. And I came to realize later, no, that was merely the catalyst that brought it on. The real cause of my anger, which was corrected through the 12-step, was the feeling of being threatened and my own lack of self-worth. Because of that, I would have to lash out to protect myself. And I got self-worth through the Al-Anon program and found out that nobody can hurt me without my approval, you know, because of this program. And I used to blame my wife for my anger, and I was a very, very angry person. I remember the first time I found a hidden bottle, and this infuriated me. I remember I took that, set it up on the kitchen counter, and I started asking those profound Al-Anon questions. Why do you do it? And I'd get this stupid answer, I don't know. And I'd say, you do too know. And she'd say, I don't know, and this would lead us into meaningful discussions. And many times, I'd tell her, if you're going to be like that, then get out. And she'd get in the car, drive around the block, come back, promise not to do those things anymore, we'd kiss and make up, going to live happily ever after, and a month later, same thing, get out. And if she was going too long, I'd get in the other car, go try to find her. There were times too when I would punish her. I wouldn't talk to her. And we could go 2, 3, 4 days, no words. And my wife used to say, those are the happiest moments of her life. I was the one with the voice. We went through all of those things that everybody goes through in alcoholism, you know, and it's all her fault. This anger was consuming me, and I was working for a partnership down there in Long Beach, and this anger was, and the situation was just so bad that I just wanted out. I didn't know what I wanted out of, I just wanted out. Prior to that, or about that time, my wife, Frank next door, got on the AA program, and my wife started watching him, and thought that maybe she should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. She talked to me previously about the drinking, and I said, don't drink so much. See, that was easy for me, but not for her. She didn't know how not to not drink so much, you know. But then, after Frank got on the AA program, Goldine thought that maybe she should go to AA. And I remember saying, I'm not going to let her be an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was, but I was not going to let her be an alcoholic. And then when she started thinking about going to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was totally against it. I didn't know anything about it, but I was totally against it, you know. But she did go to Alcoholics Anonymous anyway. Now, Frank had been a good friend of mine for a long time, but not a friend that long, where he could be taking my wife out at night. What were they up to, you know? I didn't understand AA, and I didn't give her any support in her AA. And then after about 60 days, she found out they were talking about total abstinence. She went to AA to try to find a way to control her drinking. She didn't want to stop because by that time, alcohol was her life. By that time, she couldn't function without life, without alcohol. But this anger was consuming me and situation was consuming me, and I just wanted to get out. I didn't know what I wanted to get out of. I just wanted to get out. And I was about ready to leave that job that I'd been at for quite a number of years when one of the partners found out I was about ready to leave, and he said, where do you want to go? And I had a friend in a corresponding type of a business in Riverside, California. I said, Riverside. He grub-staked us to go to Riverside. Years later, I said, Earl, why did you ever do that? He says, I don't know, something within just said to do it. Every experience is a spiritual experience. God works through a lot of people for our own benefit if we would just recognize it. Now, something very important happened. We had about 3 months advance notice before moving to Riverside. To this date, I don't remember too much about what happened during those 3 months because my wife said that when she got to Riverside, she had stopped her drinking. And this was the belief that I held. When she got to Riverside, she had stopped her drinking. When we got to Riverside, nothing changed except the hiding places, et cetera, et cetera. But I look back at that situation and ask the question, why is it that we in Al-Anon believe the promise of the alcoholic? I believe the alcoholic means the promise when they make the promise, but due to the nature of the illness, they cannot keep it. But why do we believe the promise? For me, I found out through inventory that I had come from a broken home. My parents separated and divorced when I was in my early teens. And some way or other, I had instilled within myself I was not going to have a marriage like them. I don't ever remember consciously thinking that, but it slipped in there some way or other. And it was for that reason that I was a protective husband of hers. Not for her. No. It was for me. What would people think of me married to an alcoholic like that? So I had to protect her. As far as I know, I never complained about Goldine until I came into Al-Anon, because they would know that we were not having a happy marriage, you know. And this was what I was trying to portray. And we got out to Riverside. Like I say, nothing changed except the hiding places and stuff like that. I was out there about a year, and decided to build an office onto our home. Because I bought out the interest of that business, built an office on the home. And my wife said that the reason she drank is she'd never had any responsibility. Made sense. So we put her on as a secretary. And the only thing that changed, instead of her being a drunken housewife, she was a drunken secretary. You know? By that time, she'd wake up with the shakes. She was drinking a fifth of vodka a day. And waking up with the shakes. Well, as a secretary, she couldn't write. So she had to start drinking in the morning to stop the shakes, you know. So she became a morning drinker. And in the afternoon, then she was in a blackout. And our business came in by telephone. And I was out in the field most of the time. And I'd come back, and there was some scribbling on a paper. And I go, what's that? I don't know, you know. And how that business ever survived, I'll never know, you know. We had a 16-year-old daughter. who wasn't minding Dad. So I started putting some pressure on her to bring her around. And one time I said, Barb, you start minding me, you're going to have to get out. And a little while later, I watched her packing the bags. She walked out of the house at night. And my smugness, I knew she'd be back. But she didn't come back. So I went looking for her, and I found her in a phone booth down by the freeway. And I went up to her, and I said, Barb, you start minding me, and you can come home. And she looked me right square in the eye, and she said, Dad, I'm not coming home. Now, the bad thing about self-righteousness, I see no self-righteous people here tonight. One bad thing about self-righteousness, you can never take any responsibility for what's occurring. It's always somebody else's fault. And all I was trying to do was make a lady out of that 16-year-old, and she wasn't minding me. I didn't know that I'd done anything wrong. I probably couldn't have said I was sorry. Didn't know that I was sorry. Probably didn't have the courage to say I was sorry. But I left her there in that phone booth, and I remember driving back up the house and thinking that everything that we had tried to accomplish in this marriage and life and family was going down the drain. Wife was drunk every day, daughter running away. I'd like to talk a little bit about Barb. She went down to San Pedro, lived with some friends down there, graduated from high school, married a young man who drank, and sure enough, alcoholism. For years, we told Barb, try Al-Anon. No, she didn't need Al-Anon. And I had made my amends to her. I was in the Al-Anon program by then. I made amends to her. And about 10 years into that marriage, some violence started. And she called one night and said, Dad, can I come home? I was well enough into the program of Al-Anon to realize what she was doing. She was trying to run one more time from alcoholism. And I had the courage to say, I'm sorry, Barb, you can come home for a visit, but you can't come home to live. Because I knew that she was running one more time. She ran from alcoholism, and then she tried to run again. And by my preventing her from coming home to live, she started going to Al-Anon. She got her self-worth, she got her values, her spiritual values, and the marriage didn't last. But she didn't run from the marriage. She went from the marriage to something else. So in any situation we have or faced with, we can run from it or walk through something else. We got to be careful. If we're going to run from it, we're going to meet it again right around the corner. You better believe it, because that's part of what life is trying to teach us, to walk through situations rather than to run from them. And I found that to be true in my life, in Al-Anon here. One of the things that happened when I made amends, verbal amends to my daughter, I was still left with guilt. So I said, God, remove my guilt. What it was the seventh step. I started having feelings that I should get involved in Alateen. I thought, oh God, no, not that. I don't like kids and kids don't like me. And this persisted, and I finally realized I was being told to get in Alateen. So another woman and I started an Alateen meeting. Neither one of us had any experience at Alateen, but we started an Alateen meeting, and my guilt left. It had nothing to do directly with my daughter. It had to do with the guilt that was inside of me. You see? And this is a way I found that my defects of character are removed by, first of all, identifying them, acknowledging them, wanting to get rid of them, and taking the seventh step, asking God to remove it. I hear a lot of people talk about, I'm working on my defects of character. Where does it say that in the steps? Not at all. If you're working on your defects, you'll work for a long, long time. Because what you're trying to do is use your willpower instead of God's power. So you ask God. And what God does then is bring experiences into our life for me to walk through, at least. But anyway, it usually takes me about an hour to get my wife sober. I'm not going to have that much time. But things were getting bad at home, and one night my wife did something that hurt the male ego, and I was standing over trying to figure out, should I kill her, should I kill myself, or kill both of us? And I was trying to figure out some way I might kill her and get away with it, you know. But I found this to be, for me, when I have a crazy thought, my higher power gives me a crazier thought to keep doing anything crazy. And the reason I didn't do that is, what would the neighbors think? That they obviously would know that ours is not a happy marriage, you know. About a month later, something else happened, and something similar happened. I told her to get out, and she went down to Long Beach to stay with Frank and Jenny. And they gave her 24 hours of AA, and I was left at home with two small boys trying to be the mother, father, dishwasher, and et cetera, and that, feeling absolutely miserable, but enjoying it. But after about a week, Virginia called and said, why don't you come down and reconcile? And I went down there, and I laid down the ground rules of how she'd get back in the house. She would agree to everything, anything. But that night, Virginia, and this was on June 6, 1966, easy to remember, 6-6-66, Virginia said, Bob, had you ever thought of Al-Anon? Now, my wife, during this period of time, was trying to stay sober by going in and out of AA. She could not stay sober. And occasionally, I would go to speaker meetings with her. And I could really identify between that speaker and her. And I'd give her that Al-Anon nudge, you know, listen to this. Listen. On the way home, I'd go through this speaker's talk, you know, with all these important points that she should remember. And she had given me this go-to-hell type of a look and be drunk the next day, and I couldn't understand it, you know. But when Virginia said, had you ever thought of Al-Anon, I'm sure somewhere along those AA meetings, they must have mentioned Al-Anon. But see, we hear what we need to hear when we need to hear it, not before. So I thought it was some method I could keep my wife sober. And I went to my first meeting down in Anaheim. And I walked in there, and all ladies, there wasn't a man there. And this is my life in Al-Anon. Now men are coming into Al-Anon, but there were no men then. But they had sparkles in their eyes, they had smiles on their faces, and I knew they didn't have my problem. Then they even seemed to indicate I couldn't stop my wife from drinking. I knew I could. I just needed the right technique, and Al-Anon was not it. So I was not impressed. But Virginia said, try at least 6 meetings before you make up your mind, and I did. And came back, old Ina was not going to drink anymore, and the first thing you know, she started drinking again. Nothing had changed. But I started going to Al-Anon. And something happened. And something happens in these meetings. Hopefully you grasp this. But when I went to a meeting, I felt better. I could not put my finger on it as to why I felt better. I just felt better. And the next day seemed to be better. And I couldn't, all I knew is that this occurred. So I started going to a lot of Al-Anon meetings. My wife was drinking then. And I was around Al-Anon about 6 weeks when I was feeling absolutely miserable. Now, we can be in Al-Anon or around Al-Anon. If we're around Al-Anon, things may change. If we're in Al-Anon, things will change. But I was around Al-Anon for about 6 weeks when I was feeling absolutely miserable, and I realized that Al-Anon had made me that way. That what they had done has made me aware of self. And I became very, very angry at Al-Anon. And I went to a meeting over in San Bernardino. I don't think I'd ever been there before to tell them off. And I spent about half that meeting telling them what they could do with this program. And they just sat and smiled at me. And a woman who had been sent down from Seattle, Washington to change my life, a little gray-haired lady who's undoubtedly passed away a long, long time ago, looked me right square in the eye and she said, Bob, you know now. And you have a choice. You can be miserable or you can work this program. Now, I didn't like that at all. I didn't go up and say, oh, thank you so much for the enlightenment. But I never forgot it, and I have never forgotten it, and I always like to repeat it, that you have the choice. You can be miserable or you can work this program. And that's when I became a member of Al-Anon. I no longer wanted to be miserable. I came into Al-Anon with one defect of character. An alcoholic wife. But it was surprising how many defects Al-Anon gave me in a very short period of time. When I walked through self-righteousness, and the defects started streaming here. The first defect I recognized within myself was that of anger. What would happen is I'd get angry, I'd blow my top. Most of it was verbal, not much physical. And afterwards I'd say, damn it, Bob, why don't you learn to control your temper? How could I control my temper without being aware I was losing it? It was only after the fact. So I couldn't prevent my anger because I wasn't aware of the beginning. And I was listening to these ladies talking about turning it over, letting go, let go, let God, and all this stuff. And they were the ones with smiles in their face and sparkles in their eyes. And they knew something I didn't know. But one morning, I got up and I said, God, don't let me be angry today. And at the end of the day, I had not been angry. And I remember looking, are you going to different things, certain different people? And that's, no, everything was the same except I wasn't becoming angry. And I made me aware that something was helping me not be angry. And I did that for a whole week, and for a whole week I was not angry, and that was a miracle in my life. That was 43 years ago. And from that time until now, I am always made aware of when I am becoming angry. Now I have a choice. I can hold it in, I can let it out, or, as Al-Anon has taught me, love that which makes me angry. The psychologist will say you have two choices, hold it in, let it out. Al-Anon says you have three choices, hold it in, let it out, or pray for that which makes you angry. The last choice, I always talk about a fellow named John, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who I detested. I didn't mind telling John how I felt about him. He didn't mind telling me how he felt about me. And we always had this relationship, you know, of yelling and screaming at one another. Whenever I thought about John, I'd want to get a pin and a doll and put it in there and call it John. He had had a heart attack, and I used to pray to have something a little bit more serious. I didn't care for John. And one time a person said, why don't you pray for John? I said, why should I pray for John? He said, do you like the knot in your stomach? I said, no, I don't like the knot in my stomach. He said, well, you better pray for him. I'll be damned if I will. But time went on, and that knot became more unbearable than praying for John. I started saying, God bless that son of a bitch. God bless that son of a bitch. And pretty soon the SOB would drop away, and I could sincerely say, God bless him, God bless him. And John started to change. And I went up to John one night and I said, John, I sure have to pray a lot for you. He said, Bob, I have to pray a lot for you too. What were we doing? We were using spiritual help to change our attitude and making the amends to one another. And as a result, goodness started coming into the situation. Love is the essence, beauty is the manifestation. I can create my own beauty by the use of love. Did you know that? Did you know that? And so I learned a lot about these steps from things like this, incidents. And I saw that God would remove these defects of character if I wanted them removed. Now, there are two situations I want to tell you about. My wife was trying not to drink, and she couldn't stay sober. She might have a week here, a couple of days there. She could not stop her drinking. And we had a place down in Ensenada, Mexico. We used to go down there. And Goldine had not drank for maybe a week. And we went down there, went over to some friend's house. The first thing they did is they poured a drink for her and a drink for me. And up until that time, I would have taken that drink for her and said, I'm sorry, she's not drinking tonight, thank you. Or I would have drank it myself, but I would have protected her from that alcohol. And I was not thinking about Al-Anon, I was not thinking about the first step, but something with a capital S made me aware that that was her choice and not my choice. And I sat back to see what took place. We call that detachment. Detachment comes physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And that's where I was. I was a spectator watching what was going to happen between a drink and my wife. And I saw this facial expression. She was fighting it. She was fighting it. I was not trying to encourage her not to drink it. I was there as a spectator. And pretty soon she reached over, picked up that drink, and she drank it. At that instant, something happened in the pit of my stomach and went out the top of my head in the flesh. I can still remember that. And I didn't know what happened for probably a month. And I realized that was when I took the first step. Because from that instant until now, I never tried to stop her from drinking. I was free. But also, she was free. She was free to drink herself to death if this is what she wanted to do. And I was free to allow it if that's what she wanted. Now, had you ever thought that God allows us to destroy ourselves? What right do I have to go greater than that, huh? I had to let go of her. And as a result of that, the bottle came out from the hiding place. I walked in the kitchen at times, and there she was drinking her warm vodka. And I was... Al-Anon had taught me that the basic thing that it took two to have an argument, if I kept my mouth shut, there wouldn't be an argument. And I used that arguing stock. But one night at an Al-Anon meeting, I was complaining about this drunken secretary I had. And the wise Al-Anon said, if she was other than your wife, would you keep her? I said, of course not. End of the conversation, but not the end of the thought. If she had been other than my wife, I would have fired her in a moment for being drunk on the job all the time. So the principle of that is, why do we treat relatives differently than people? Why do we treat relatives differently than people? And I gave a lot of thought to that. And I gave thought, I said, you know, I could live in this situation. By that time, there was nothing left of the marriage. I could live in that situation. But I said, there's something more to life than I was experiencing. So I sat Goldine down one Friday night and I said, I don't care whether you drink, but not in this house. If you're going to drink, you're going to have to get out. With that, I fired her. What happened for me, I had become willing to let the relatives, friends, and neighbors know that ours was not a successful marriage. I was holding on to a falsehood. And I had to free myself of that falsehood and walk through the spiritual pride of letting people know that I was a failure as a husband. Now, one of the nice things about the Al-Anon program has taught me to find success in the Al-Anon program, you first have to admit that you're a failure. Now, don't do that outside here, because outside here, you're taught to be a success. In Al-Anon, you're taught to be a failure, because when you acknowledge that you're a failure, you allow a power greater than yourself to come into the situation. Now, at that same time, something happened to my wife. See, I'd become willing to give up the marriage, and what I had done really without knowing it at that time is I had put the marriage on a scale of 1 to 10 down towards the bottom, and what I had done is brought up to the number 1, my emotional comfortableness was the number one priority. And where do I get the number one priority? Through the 12 steps. Where do I get the 12 steps? Through Al-Anon. So I had to put Al-Anon first in my life, and I put that in my life ever since. Al-Anon is number one in my life. Now for my wife, in her story, she talks about how at that time, that night, she didn't care whether she drank, didn't care whether she didn't drink, didn't care whether she lived, didn't care whether she died. She went through total surrender. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous uses the term surrender. Al-Anon uses the term detachment. I think that they are both the same in principle. What it is to give up. And as a result of giving up, you allow a power greater than yourself to come into the situation to make it all okay. And that's the secret that I found in Al-Anon. So she found sobriety in September. She had 43 years. And when she got sober, it wasn't necessarily a happy, happy marriage. Many times I thought, my God, it wasn't this bad when she was drinking, you know. But what happened... What happened is I came to realize all these emotions of hate, disgust, and all of those things were coming up inside of me. And I was the one that was uncomfortable. So I said, God, teach me to love her as she is. And she started to change. Now, the big question is, did she change or did my perception of her change? What difference does it make? What difference does it make? She is a very, very beautiful person in my life today. We haven't had an argument in 42 years. That doesn't mean we agree all the time. We don't have to agree. Why do we have to agree on everything? We have to, but we don't have to argue about our disagreements, you know. So she's a very, very beautiful person in my life. She puts AA first in her life. I put Al-Anon first in my life. And as a result of that, we have a good relationship. Okay, we've got about time to wrap it up, but I want to tell you one story in Gordon Goldin. A couple of years after her sobriety, I was taking her inventory. I don't take inventories anymore. I make loving observations. I was taking her inventory and realized she had never made amends to me. You know, how could she be comfortable? How could she be sober? How could she, you know, without having made amends to me? I never thought, no, Bob, you know, you work your program. Let her work her program. Leave it alone. Leave it alone. So a couple more years went by, and I was walking to the kitchen one day, and she was reading her AA Grapevine magazine, and as she, when I went by, she said, Bob, have I ever made amends to you? And I thought, uh-oh, here it comes. I said to myself, now be careful, don't interrupt, because this is important to her. Take a, you know, get comfortable, because it's going to take a long time. I folded my arms, backed up against the kitchen counter, and said, no, you never have. She said, well, I'm sorry. She went back reading her magazine. Now, what's the lesson in that? What right do I have to expect anybody to make amends to me? If I'm waiting for somebody to make amends to me, am I not holding on to a resentment? So my job is to clean up my side of the street, let the other person clean up their side of the street. And that's what this program, I think, is all about. I have a good relationship with God. Boil down two words. Two words. Available, usable. I have to be available, keep saying yes when asked to do certain things in Al-Anon, and let God find me usable. I was sharing with somebody here. I spoke up at Yosemite a couple of years ago, and the secretary, the person who invited me up, introduced me at the luncheon there, and she said she had invited me. And I made a correction. I said that was really was not true. It was God through her who invited me. So always keep this in mind when you're asked to do something for Al-Anon. It is not that person who is asking you. It's that person that is God through that person who is asking you. So for that reason, always, always, always find reasons to say yes rather than excuses to say no. So I appreciate being here. Thank you.